Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Okay, campers, rise and shine, and don't forget your booties, because it's cold out there.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
It's Groundhog Day!
You're having fun, aren't you, Cyrus?
What would you do,
Cyrus, has a
if you were stuck in one place and every day was exactly the same and nothing that you did mattered?
Now that sums it up for me.
This movie's so funny. I love it.
I want Bill Murray to play me in the Patrick Madrid story.
There you go. There you go.
And the guy who played Ned Ryerson could be you.
Thanks a whole lot.
Watch out for that first step. It's a doozy.
By the way, everybody and his brother came out of the woodwork and immediately said it's Woodstock, Illinois, because I said
yep, that's what happened.
Right, it's Woodstock.
Yeah.
Instantaneously, people are popping up.
Oh, that's too funny. I love it. The other day I had to ask, we were talking about waterfalls, that dumb waterfall song. And I was like, I couldn't remember who did it. And so I just did a quick, hey, who did that song? And sure enough, I was getting emails and tweets. And it's really cool when people are like, I'll help you out.
Yeah. I posted a picture on Twitter yesterday. Bright blue sky, sunshine. I got my sunglasses on, my Ray-Bans, and I'm holding an In-N-Out Burger wrapper. People went wild. And all of us, you know, it inevitably, you've got the people who say, no, 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 it's Whataburger or whatever it's called. That's the best one. So the burger war started up, and everybody's saying, you know, most people agreed. I think, how can you not agree that In-N-Out Burger is the best burger on the planet? But all the diehard Whataburger people, they came out to make their to cast their vote. But whatever.
Yeah, I know the real In-N-Out Burger. The real reason you posted that was for
me. Oh, do you?
Oh yeah, I'm sure
of
it.
Oh, that was for you.
It was for me, to because you knew I was getting dumped on with 18 feet of snow while you were out there in your shorts and sunglasses eating an In-N-Out Burger with the beautiful blue sky behind you and palm trees. I saw what you did
no
there.
No snow on the ground.
Yeah, I saw.
No snow on the ground, by the way. Because, you know, 72, 73 degree weather, you can't have snow like that.
Anyway, there's some wonderful callers waiting.
Yeah, I just want to mention real quick before we, and we will go, but I just want to mention a couple quick things. So, yeah, nod of the hat to all the people who jumped up and said Woodstock, Illinois. Thank you for that. Cindy Gonzalez on Twitter says, Patrick, listening this morning about your experience working with the elderly, I was feeling burned out from my job as a medical social worker. After listening to your story, I'm reminded of my original calling. Thank you.
That's
she has the prayer
awesome.
Hands emoji. That's cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Miss Ellie says, I'm not crying, and she put a crying emoji. I think she's probably referring to maybe the movie, The Father, that we talked about. And Kathy L. says, dang, missed the name of the movie you're talking about today. Can you mention it again? Was it The Father about dementia? Yeah, it's called The Father, and it's starring Anthony Hopkins. Joe Chavez on Twitter says, the older I get, the more I appreciate the preciousness of time. I only have so much of it allotted to me. He's quoting something that I said. Well, that's kind of you, Joe. Thank you. And then lastly, Blue Crab on Twitter says, what was that movie, Patrick? It was called The Father. So check it out. Let's get to the phones, as promised. Let's go to Jim now in San Diego. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a couple of comments I'd like to make before we actually get into answering my question. My question is, why did Jesus say, call no man father? And the comments I want to make, you've given outstanding answers explaining what he didn't intend or mean. But I've never heard an answer as to what he did mean by it. And also, this ties in with a question you had the other day about why did Jesus say that he was would teach things in puzzles. I don't think he used the word puzzles, but he would teach things that people would not see or understand and so on. Okay?
Sure. So that calls a passage in Mark's gospel, I believe it was in Mark's gospel, where Jesus says that I teach them in parables so that they would not see and they would not believe. And it seemed puzzling. It is puzzling because why wouldn't Jesus want people to understand? I explained that it was because the time had not come yet. And he also wanted his apostles to be the ones who preached these truths to the people. So as to your first question, we know that in Matthew chapter 23, verse 9, where Jesus says, call no one on earth Father, for you have but one Father who is in heaven. If we just looked at that one passage, it would suggest that we should never call any man Father, whether in a religious sense or otherwise, because that seems to be what Jesus is saying there. But in fact, it's not. The context is him excoriating the scribes and Pharisees. And he says this just before he launches into them as hypocrites and brood of vipers and blind guides and whitewashed tombs and all of the things that he says about them. He begins by saying that they're hypocrites because they tie up heavy burdens, but they don't lend a finger to help anybody. He says that they are bad examples, that even though they've taken their seat on the chair of Moses, which is an oral tradition from the Old Testament, the chair of Moses was symbolic of the authority of the rabbi to teach to teach the congregation. So he's invoking their authority, but he's saying don't do what they do because they're living not according to God's law and purpose, but rather according to their own. And he actually gives an example of what he's talking about in Matthew chapter 7, and that's where he talks about the korban rule. And that was a rule that these very same men had developed over time, in which you could avoid the commandment to honor your father and mother, which includes financial assistance if that's what's necessary. And they had this scheme rigged up where you could korban your money. Korban is the Hebrew the Hebrew word that refers to dedicating it to some holy purpose. And so you could say, well, my money is dedicated to the Lord. I've given all my money, so to speak, to the temple. I don't really have it anymore, mom and dad. I can't give you any money. I wish I could, but I don't have any money. But the trick was that you had free use of your money. So it was a technicality that you could say, technically, I don't have any money, therefore I can't help you, mom and dad. Therefore, you would be getting out of your obligation to honor your father and mother. And of course, Jesus condemns this as a tradition of men. He says, you know, for your traditions, you have nullified the word of God. In the case of the commandment to honor your father and mother. So when Jesus is speaking about these very same men in Matthew chapter 23, his apostles, of course, remember that this is what he said. By the way, I mistakenly said Matthew chapter 7. That's Mark chapter 7. But Jesus also says the same thing about the traditions of men in Matthew chapter 15. So what happens here is Jesus is saying, and you're asking, what does he actually mean by this as opposed to what are the things he doesn't mean? What he means is don't look to the scribes and Pharisees as your father because they're trying to put themselves in that role in your life. They're trying to lord it over you in a way where you have to obey them when your father is the one that you should be obeying. And when these guys come up with this nonsense, you should not look to them as your father. Now, you'll notice that this is not just, it's not the only thing that he says. So in verse 9, he says, call no one on earth father. But he says in verse 8, call no one on earth teacher or rabbi. And then in verse 10, he says, call no one on earth, I'm sorry, I have it backwards, master and then teacher. Teacher is in verse 10. And the reason that that's significant as bookends, kind of bracketing when he says this about father, is because the people who object to this would not otherwise object to you having a master's degree. You have a master of arts. You are a master of arts, or you're a master craftsman. Well, if Jesus literally meant don't call priests father in verse 9, then he also means don't say that you have a master's degree, because that too would be forbidden. And it's not. He didn't mean that. And the same would be true of teacher. And the Latin word doctor is one of the Latin words for teacher. So anybody who's got a doctorate is offending this passage if Jesus literally meant it. So back to your question, what did he literally mean? He literally meant, don't look to the scribes and Pharisees, or by extension, other religious figures, as your master or your father or your teacher, the way God alone is. But he didn't mean that you can't refer to people in that sense. So he used a kind of hyperbolic statement to make his point. I guess I'll leave it at that. Does that clarify it a bit better for you, Jim?
Patrick, you're delightful. You just added to my knowledge on something. But I want to share with you something that I think you obviously have not noticed. And it's been over 65 years I've been a Catholic. And the last one, I just discovered this last Sunday about what Jesus meant. You know, all the details have been in my knowledge, and I'm sure they're in yours. Jesus, in part, was saying, call no man father, that you have one father in heaven, because he's referring to the fact of that God is our father in the rebirth that we receive through baptism. Now, isn't that an interesting little detail? And there's one more. Go ahead, make a comment if you like.
No, go right ahead, Jim.
Okay, the other one I just discovered this last Sunday, and again, Jesus is God is truly our Father, and even more so than our human Father, because God creates the spiritual soul that is a part of our being, whereas our mm-hmm. human Father merely is involved in the beginning of our physical body, you know, with the help of the mother.
Right.
The two together.
That's right.
And so it's really our body that he's the father of only, not our spiritual soul. That's from God, the Father. So that's it.
Yeah, God is the one who makes the soul. That is true.
So those two things, I just, one a few years back and the other just Sunday, this last Sunday, figured it out.
Isn't it great when you get those kind of insights out of the blue seemingly, and suddenly
yeah,
now
I find
a passage
it awesome.
Takes on new meaning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I was being puzzled by the question, but I certainly know that God helped in my seeing the answer.
No doubt.
It wasn't me alone.
No doubt.
And
no
so,
doubt. Well, that's I would say that's a delightful topic to bring up on the air, Jim, and I thank you for that.
Yeah, and there's one more detail about why did Jesus speak in parables and such, and I think Scripture is loaded with this. I see Scripture as very similar, very analogous to the isolated pieces of a jigsaw puzzle when you first open it. And I think it's delightful that God has set these puzzles for us. Everybody loves mm-hmm. to solve puzzles to one degree or another. And mm-hmm. God has set this task for us. At least that's the way I see it.
Yeah. That's a good point. It's a very good point, yeah. I would agree. Okay. Well, I'm glad we could resolve that, Jim. Thank you. Nice to chat with you. Appreciate it very much. 8149. How about Rhonda now in Dubuque? Good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning. My question is, why do so many people hate Jewish people so much? Jesus was a Jew.
Jesus was a Jew. Mary is a Jew. The apostles were Jews. So, yeah, I have gone round and round with some people. So first of all, let me just say, I don't know why. I don't understand it. I've never really understood the hatred that people have for Jews. And it seems to be something preternatural because they have been the scapegoats and the victims of oppression and terrible things done to them for, you know, forever. I mean, they were enslaved by the Egyptians for 400 years. Moses had to get them out of there. So it's not as though anti-Semitism or whatever we want to call it back in the olden days is something new. So I don't claim to understand why people have this hatred for the Jews, but whatever the source of it is, we need to stand up against anti-Semitism. It's a form of racism. Did you hear about Whoopi Goldberg being, she got suspended for 2 weeks because she said on an interview program that the Holocaust was not about race. It was about, what does she call it? It was not about race. It was about
I have it right here if you want to hear it.
Something. Hatred. Oh, you have her statement? Okay, let's play it.
Well, also, if you're going to do this, then let's be truthful about it, because the Holocaust isn't about race.
No.
It's well, not about race.
It is. Well, yeah. No, it's Jews about a different race.
But it's not about race. It's not about race.
What is it about?
Because it's about man's inhumanity to man. That's what it's about.
But it's about white supremacy. It's about going after Jews, ideal race.
But these are two
Romans.
White groups of people.
Well, that how was after black
but
people,
see
too.
Them as white
and they but you're missing the point. You're missing the point. The minute you turn it into race, it goes down this alley. Let's talk about it for what it is. It's how people treat each other. It's a problem. It doesn't matter if you're black or white. Because black... Right.
Oh, she Jews, keeps going.
It's how everybody.
It's just nonsense.
So is it if you're uncomfortable if you hear about mouse?
I'm uncomfortable.
All right.
She manages to get just about everything wrong. I remember, and I'm still with you, Rhonda, and I'm using this as a kind of extension into your question about why do people hate Jews so much. There's just a lot of nonsense out there, and Whoopi Goldberg has always sort of struck me as somebody who thinks long and hard before coming up with the wrong answer, time after time after time. So I'm not surprised that she would say this, and partly because I think maybe she thinks she has a lock on the race issue because she's black. Maybe yeah. That's what she was trying to do. I mean, she's given some explanations that I think... pretty mealy-mouthed.
Do you remember when she said President Biden's
Jill
wife?
Jill Biden would make Oh, yeah, he said Dr. Jill Biden would make a great Surgeon General. And then somebody else, she'd be fantastic.
And then everybody
claps. She doesn't know anything about her. Wow. And then somebody points out, well, she has a doctorate in education.
Here, you know what? I found it. This only takes a second.
You have
when Dr. Jill becomes a Surgeon General, his wife.
Yeah,
because she's a hell of a doctor. She's an amazing doctor.
I thought she was a doctor, PhD.
I could be wrong.
I think she's a teacher, but you know, might be good for Betsy DeVos's post.
I like how.
Yes.
All right. It's all I can take. My ears are bleeding. I'm amazed, though, Cyrus, that you had that audio. It's almost like, I want to be kind. Have you ever met somebody who doesn't really think before they speak, Cyrus?
I look at them in the mirror every morning.
No, don't be hard on yourself. I think, and you notice that she backed down in mid-sentence. She'd be a great doctor. She'd be a wonderful doctor.
I like how the crowd is clapping.
Yeah, they're going along with it because they don't know any better either. But anyway, back to Rhonda's question about why did people hate Jews so much. Whoopi Goldberg stepped in it because of what she said. So she got suspended, slap on the wrist, if you ask me. It's just a token gesture. I don't really know what that will accomplish. But people, for some reason, Rhonda, have hated Jews forever. And why that is, I mean, they have their own reasons. You know, stupid Adolf Hitler had his reasons, which he spelled out in Mein Kampf. And his reasons were, you know, his reasons, I don't believe them, of course, but he was telling the people of Germany after World War I, as he was rising to power steadily, he wrote Mein Kampf, and I believe he wrote it while he was in prison for his political activities. But in any case, he said, the reason you're having all these problems is because of the Jews. Because the Jews control the banks, and the Jews control the money, and the Jews control you. And if you want to live free, and if you want to be pure-blooded and all the other nonsense that he was spouting, you need to get rid of the Jews. And that's what he spelled out in Mein Kampf, and that's what he did. Of course, thankfully, he was stopped, but he killed 6 million Jews before he was stopped because he really did believe those terrible things, and he got a lot of other people to line up behind him. And once again, the Jews were the scapegoats for that. There have been times on this program, although thankfully it hasn't happened in a long time, you get a couple people here and there, Catholic folk, who hate the Jews, and they're not at all hesitant to say it out loud, and they call and you know, the same thing. The Jews control the media and the Jews control this, and therefore the Jews control you. And I don't know where that hatred comes from. I really don't. So I guess I have to give you an I don't know answer to your question, Rhonda. I acknowledge the problem, but I don't know the source of it, other than people who are maybe ignorant of history, or for some reason there's a place in their souls where they nurture hatred against a group of people simply because of their ethnicity or their skin color, their race, what have you. I don't get it. So there's my answer, Rhonda. Kind of a long-winded answer, if ever there were one.
Yeah. We don't understand it either. We were watching that Whoopi thing last night too, and I can't figure it out. My husband was an altar boy. He can't figure it out. It doesn't make sense to us.
I'm going to make a prediction. At some point, probably it will happen on social media. It probably will happen on Twitter. It may well be that somebody will pop up and explain why they hate Jews, or why we all should hate Jews. And it always saddens me when that happens, especially when it comes from a Catholic. But thankfully, Rhonda, so much has been done, especially since the pontificate of Pope John Paul II, and especially Pope John Paul II. He went out of his way to repair relationships with Jews in various Jewish communities. And he did a lot of good to reverse a lot of the things that have been done by Catholics against Jews in the past. So we can be thankful for that. Progress has been made, and that's something we should rejoice in. I've got to take a break, though, Rhonda. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back with more right after this.
Hey, there's a line open, so now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
I got you, babe.
I see what you're doing, sir. Yeah, I see it. I get it. Not bad. 888-914-9149. John in Riverside, thank you for your patience and welcome to the program.
Hello, I had a question. I had a Protestant pastor hand me something about the Catholic Church, and it was basically a timeline. And the purpose of presenting me this was trying to say, like, look at all these weird things that came after, you know, the life of Jesus. And one of them was the Assumption in 1950. And this one kind of made me defensive because it makes it seem like the Pope in 1950 suddenly pulled this doctrine out of his hat and said, look, everybody, when we know that's not the case. I know at least that St. Dominic, the rosary, when it was given to him in the 13th century, one of the mysteries included the Assumption. So how far back did this teaching go traditionally? And when did it kind of, you know, start, so to speak?
Yeah, this is another one of those spurious arguments against the Catholic Church that well-meaning but ignorant Protestants will raise. And the truth of the matter is that, of course, the Assumption of Our Lady, it's taught by the Church because it happened. It was an historical event. And although in the first 2 to 3 centuries of the Church's existence, we don't have a written record of it. We do begin to see references to it almost immediately after the persecution by the Roman Empire of the Church ceased definitively. And that took place in the early 4th century. Now, this is also true, just by way of comparison, this is also true of other very important things like the high Christology that developed and a high understanding of the Trinity that developed after the persecutions were over as well. There were heresies that called into question the divinity of Jesus, for example, the Arian heresy, to name one. And it wasn't until the Roman Empire stopped persecuting the Church that the Church was able to catch its breath and begin to deal with these issues and start writing about them. And so we see a profusion of theological and biblical literature, not biblical books, but literature, commentaries on Scripture that pour forth as early as, let's say, the early part of the 4th century or the early 300s. And the same is true for references to Mary's bodily assumption. So although there is a gap in time, one could not correctly argue that similarly, because there's a gap of a couple of hundred years in which the church was not writing about the Trinity or not writing about the full divinity of Jesus, that therefore those were rabbits out of a hat. You know, suddenly the church decided to invent this doctrine about the divinity of Jesus or the Trinity. This, by the way, is exactly what Jehovah's Witnesses tell people. Talk about well-meaning ignorance. They're very ignorant on the topic. The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society actually published a comic book-sized booklet back in the 80s, I think it was, Why You Shouldn't Believe in the Trinity. And it's their effort to make the same claim that the Trinity was this rabbit out of a hat that the church proclaimed. There you go. That the church proclaimed at the time of the First Council of Nicaea in the year 325. Now, it's bad theology and it's bad history, but they still make that claim. So I would liken that to what this Protestant minister is saying about the bodily assumption of Mary. He just doesn't know the history of it. Now, if you want the history, if you want articles and quotes from the church fathers that go way back and other things on the topic, that's all readily available for free at the Catholic Answers website, catholic.com. So if you just type in bodily assumption, you'll pull up articles. There are some tracts. There's a lot there. And that, I think, will assist you in helping get his mind right so that he'll understand that just because he gave you this infographic, that there's much more to the story than he realizes. Any thoughts on that, John?
Cool. Yeah, thank you so much. Just a quick follow-up. Let's put on our, you know, let's pick up our Book of Mormon here just for fun. Do you think it's possible, you say, that this doctrine wasn't kind of really hammered out until after the persecution had been lifted, I'm guessing from the Edict of Milan or whatever. Is it possible that this doctrine and possibly others could have been some of those quote-unquote pagany doctrines that crept their way into Christianity, given with, you know, the end of the persecution that some folks might argue, like, you know, the Mormon Church or maybe the Jehovah's Witnesses? What are your thoughts?
So, yes, I'm familiar with those two groups' claims that in the case of the Mormon Church, they claim that it was exactly or precisely because of this syncretism between true Christianity, as they would regard it, and Hellenistic philosophy and pagan ideas, that the great apostasy, as they claim, took place because the church was so corrupted. So yeah, I'm very familiar with the argument, and it would just depend upon which particular issue they wanted to deal with that we would have to turn to the patristic testimony, the biblical evidence. And so it would be incorrect to make an argument from silence to say that simply because we don't have extant records of a given doctrine being discussed in the, say, second or third century, therefore it must be a later invention. That would be a logical fallacy. It's an argument from silence. So one way to respond to that would be to say, well, there are very, very possibly untold numbers of documents that are lost to us because in antiquity, as you know, they didn't have acid-free paper and they didn't have ways to preserve documents the way we do now. And so a great deal of, including the manuscripts themselves, the autographs of the New Testament, those are lost as well. So the fact that we don't have them doesn't mean necessarily that there was no discussion or comment or writing about it. But it would be difficult, if not impossible, I believe, to somehow disprove or to claim that when the patristic testimony begins commenting on this and they reference this as a doctrine that had been handed down from the time of the apostles, and this was readily understood, universally accepted, and you don't see, let's say, the church in Corinth or the church in Rome or the church in some other apostolically established city rising up and saying, what on earth are you talking about? We never heard anything about this. We never heard anything about the Blessed Virgin Mary being bodily assumed into heaven. Where are you getting this stuff from? You don't see that either. You don't see an outcry, and you do see that kind of outcry whenever a heresy popped up that was indeed a heresy. You see the church resorting to not just the written word, but also apostolic tradition, saying, this is not what we were taught by the apostles. This deviates from what we were taught by the apostles. We see it as early as St. Ignatius of Antioch, who in the year 107 was on his way to Rome to be martyred. Now, he, of course, was a disciple of St. John the Apostle, who was at the Last Supper. He seems also to have known St. Peter. So he knew at least two of the apostles, and he tells us in his letters that he learned the faith from St. John the Apostle. That's where he became acquainted with the gospel. So one of the apostles taught him, and as an example, although this doesn't deal with Mary or Christology, but it's another parallel that I think is helpful, St. Ignatius of Antioch says, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you meet somebody who doesn't believe what we believe, namely that the Eucharist is the flesh of Christ that suffered for our salvation, then stay away from that person. Avoid that person, he says, because, and you see as he develops this theme in his letters, that we are called to accept and follow what the apostles themselves delivered, having received this from the Holy Spirit and from Jesus. And if anyone deviates from that, then he's not teaching the truth. And he gave an example of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist to support this claim. So there's a great deal there, but I do think you're going to find a lot of good material at the Catholic Answers website, John. Thank you. Let's see, 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Crystal Lake, Illinois, and talk to Lisa. Oh. I'm guessing that Crystal Lake is more like Ice Lake today, right, in the middle of February?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It is very cold and very windy and snowy. Thanks, Patrick. I just wanted to tell you my story. My husband and I have been together for almost 32 years, five children, six grandchildren. And my parents, my husband's Jewish. And my parents showed my husband so much love and compassion and understanding of, I mean, we've been together since we've been 17. He converted 20 years after we were married to Catholicism. My parents thought it was the best thing in the world that we had, my mother used to always say, the beginning of the story and the end of the story. And she used to brag about having a Jewish son-in-law. Mm-hmm. So it breaks my heart that the world is trying to, you know, what did they always say? You can't repeat history. I mean, we don't do these things. We don't hate people because of their faith. And if we continue to be, you know, if we continue to have hatred in the world, we'll never ever be able to communicate Jesus's love and his passion, his compassion and his teachings. I mean, I never asked my husband to convert. I loved him for who he is. And it was our children, it was my parents that made him see how much love and compassion Jesus had for everybody, not just Christians or Catholics.
Beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. 1 John chapter 2, verse 9 says, "He who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in the darkness still." Now, some people would argue, well, the Jew is not my brother. You know, they might come back with that argument. But I think that this extends beyond the true brotherhood that Christians experience through baptism. The principle is certainly true. You know, it's interesting, and I think it's a beautiful story that you're telling, and it's also to the point about how our actions with people have a lot to do with the decisions that they wind up making, and decisions that they make about God based upon what they see. I can only imagine that if St. Paul, or if, let's say, you and your husband were alive at the time of St. Paul, St. Paul would probably have loved your husband and really would have been able to relate to him and share so much because of their common culture and heritage. But I'll bet you St. Paul would have been very upfront about saying to him, you need to accept Jesus. You need to believe in Jesus. Because that's what he did. You know, he told the Jews everywhere he went that they needed to receive Jesus. So my thinking, Lisa, is that we should always adopt what you are espousing, and that is to be loving, to be respectful, to be charitable, don't be pushy, all those things. I completely endorse what you're saying. But I would only add to that, that we also must tell people the good news. So I always feel uncomfortable with the idea of simply not evangelizing, not telling somebody the truth about Jesus simply because I don't want to ruffle anyone's feathers. I think that there's a, well, not that I think, I know that there's a place for that. And sometimes it can be tricky to figure out how to do that. And at the same time, not be pushy, you know, and to be respectful. That can be a difficulty sometimes. But I just wanted to add that in there so that people don't feel as though they should just not say anything about Jesus if they have a wonderful Jewish relative.
Oh, yes. And Patrick, my husband, when my husband and I went to go see The Passion, and my husband came out, he couldn't even speak. I mean, I don't think we talked to each other about it for a couple of days, but I said to him finally, if you were there, what do you think you would have done? Would you have walked away from
our Lord?
Are you
asking me or are you asking him?
I was asking my husband this. Mm-hmm. And I said, would you would have walked away or would you would have followed Jesus? He said, oh my goodness, I would have followed him. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I think by watching that movie and seeing that was like, oh my gosh, this really happened. This man was here. Mm-hmm. And before we saw The Passion, he used to think Jesus was just a prophet. Mm-hmm. And then after, yeah,
with some good ideas, like,
yes, mm-hmm. yes, he was watching that movie, brought him to that time and place, and then made him think, oh my goodness, yes, if I was there, I would have followed him.
Mm-hmm. And was it shortly after that that he became a Catholic?
Yes. Yes. He asked my daughter when she was making her first communion, this was our third daughter. And he said to her, Nicole, do you really believe this? This is second grade. And she said, oh, Daddy, I believe it. And right after that mm-hmm. is when he went to CHRP. Then he went to RCIA.
That's great.
And that was the story.
Well, God bless him. And what a blessing for you, Lisa. I mean, you were patiently waiting. And
God's time.
Look what happened. How awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a wonderful day, Patrick. Thank you for letting me share that story, our story.
You're most welcome, Lisa. Most welcome. Nice to hear from you. 888-914-9149. That worked out perfectly as far as break time goes. So we'll do that. We'll come right back to more of your phone calls. 888-914-9149. And although I'm a bit delayed in that letter from a mom asking about advice for her son who says he's an atheist now. I'm going to share that with you on the other side of this quick timeout.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no yellow mountain we can't climb.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
You ever feel
Cyrus,
like you're just hearing the same...
You're easily amused.
I am easily amused. You ever feel like you just hear the same bumper music over and over again?
No.
Good.
No, but I can ask the kitchen. Ned? Ned Ryerson?
It's the best.
All right. This is serious business here. Okay, so this is an email that comes in from Tammy. Dear Patrick, my 31-year-old son is in prison and has claimed to be an atheist for years. He was baptized Lutheran. I am Catholic. I, however, don't believe he's an atheist. While in prison, he reads a lot of books, and from a recent letter I received from him, I see opportunity knocking. A friend of his overdosed a few years back, and my son's comment was, quote, Chance was an atheist, and when he died, his parents gave him a Catholic funeral. I think that's disrespectful. I know what to tell him. She says, I know what to tell him to address this comment, but I thought maybe you would have a recommendation for a book to send him regarding the atheist behavior. She says he was an alcoholic to the point of trying to drink himself to death when his wife left him. He ended up in prison due to buying drugs for a girl to impress her. Sad story. Well, so she's asking for a good book. There are plenty of really good books out there, and I'll just give you a few. So, Tammy, hopefully any one of these will be helpful to you. I would recommend Dr. Peter Kraft and Father Ron Ticelli's monumental book called Handbook of Catholic Apologetics. The first 25% or so is devoted to responding to atheist claims. It's very good. And they take all of the arguments that atheists make, all the major ones and some of the minor ones too, and it's like bowling pins. They set them up and then they knock them down. And I teach at a couple of different colleges. I teach apologetics, and that's the textbook that my students have to study because it's so good. So I'd recommend that. I would recommend a book called The Last Superstition by Dr. Edward Feser, F-E-S-E-R. Looks like Fesser, but it's pronounced Feser. The Last Superstition. It's a critique of atheist claims. Very good. He's a philosopher. He teaches at Pasadena City College, and he's very good, razor sharp. I would recommend if there's a way for your son to be able to see this, and in prison it may not be possible, but there's a YouTube debate between William Lane Craig, a Protestant philosopher, and the late Christopher Hitchens, one of the so-called Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, in company with Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and, what was the other guy? The God Delusion. It'll come to me. It's crazy because he's such a well-known guy. And I know that all the people on Twitter are going to pop up and tell me his name, just like Woodstock, Illinois. Richard Dawkins, there we go. That is a very good debate. It's called Does God Exist? And it was held at Biola University in Southern California some years ago. It's about 2 hours long. And it was a debate featuring one of the leading atheists and a leading Christian philosopher. And William Lane Craig destroys Christopher Hitchens' arguments. So if there's a way for your son to be able to view that video in prison, that would be very helpful. For my part, I co-authored a book with Ken Hensley called The Godless Delusion, and that is our critique of modern atheism. And that would be a way for your son to see how atheism itself cannot account for reality as we know it. It can't account for where things come from in the first place. Why do things exist at all? And so we, in essence, in that book, offer our critique of atheist principles to show that atheism as a worldview can't really remain coherent and at the same time take into account non-physical realities, things such as love and honesty, memory, human dignity, truth itself. These are all non-material realities, and the essence of the atheist worldview is that the only things that exist are material, that everything is reducible to material, because if that's not true, then that means that there's some supernatural realm. And if there's a supernatural realm, that opens the door for the existence of gods. That means the existence of an afterlife, possibly. So the thoroughgoing atheist worldview is naturalistic in its premises, meaning that the only things that do exist are purely natural, meaning physical. So in this book, The Godless Delusion, we tackle that issue. So those are a few. I think any one of those would be helpful to you. As I say, there are other fine books on the topic, but I don't want to deluge you with too many examples. I hope that's helpful. Thank you. Let's go to Alex now in Smithfield, North Carolina. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. My question is that when we die, we go to our last judgment, right? So,
yes.
On the Creed, mm-hmm. when it says God will come and judge the living and the dead, so where will the dead, where are the dead? Do I explain myself?
Yeah, no, you do. I understand. So, the first judgment, as it says in Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So that's what we would think of as a particular judgment. So when you die, you will have your personal judgment at that point. And then at the end, when Jesus, as he talks about in Matthew chapter 25, you know, when he says that then the Son of Man will come back to judge the nations, and he'll come back in glory with his angels, and he will separate humanity into two groups, the sheep and the goats. I'm sure you're familiar with that passage. So there we see the general judgment. And it's not only there. There are other passages in Scripture that talk about it. But there we see Jesus talking about that general judgment. And so the living and the dead part of it means that when Jesus returns, there will be people still alive on the earth. In fact, St. Paul describes what happens to them in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where he says that we who are still alive will be caught up into the air with the Lord and go to be with the Lord. So that's when this rapture event takes place at the very end when Jesus returns. It's not a secret rapture or a pre-tribulation rapture or any of those things. So those people who are still alive will be translated into eternity. All of those who have died will be present, and we will all receive our bodies back. So the glorified bodies for those who go to heaven, and the bodies of the damned, they'll all have their bodies as well. And it's at that time that this general judgment takes place in which everything is made public. So at your personal judgment, your sins are known to God, of course, but they're not made known to anyone else. And your eternal, reward, either in heaven or in hell, that's also not public. But in the general judgment, these things are made public. So as Jesus said, what is done in darkness will be shouted from the rooftops. What is whispered in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. What is done in darkness or secret will be exposed to the light, and these things will be made public. Now, I'm personally convinced that the blessed who are going to heaven will not have their embarrassing sins made public, and that's my hope, but the damned certainly will. And then everybody will see the justice and the mercy of God. So that's the public nature of this final judgment, so that everybody knows where everybody is going, and God's glory in his justice and his mercy is manifested. Does that answer your question?
It does. And I have one more. What was Hebrew? Sure. What? Can you repeat that?
Oh, Hebrews 9:27.
9:27. Okay. And I have another question that goes with this. So when we die, is it, and you know that there's a lot of people being cremated, is it okay to be cremated, mm-hmm. or is it just be buried in
I'll give you my opinion, and also I'll tell you what the church says on the topic. So the church historically has forbidden cremation outside of a strange situation like a plague, where they have to burn bodies to prevent the plague from spreading. Okay, there are circumstances where it's inevitable, and the church didn't object to that. But as a matter of how do you deal with the remains of a baptized Christian, the church always forbade cremation, in part because there was this notion that some people held that if you could destroy the body utterly, then it would disprove the idea of a general resurrection. It would somehow mean that God couldn't resurrect your body on the last day. Of course, God can do anything, you know, that's not contrary to his nature. So for that reason, among others, the church forbade it. But in recent decades, the church has relaxed that restriction and now permits cremation if people choose it. So I'll pivot there to my personal opinion, and that's all this is. It doesn't carry any weight whatsoever, but it's just the way I view the issue. I find cremation horrifying and repugnant because it's the intentional destruction of the body, and I just recoil from that. So if somebody were to ask me for my advice would be, you know, if it's financially doable, I would encourage people to be buried as opposed to being cremated. Now, that's simply my own personal view and nothing more.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're asking my advice, that would be my advice. But the church does say you can. It has relaxed that restriction.
Okay. Well, I think you answered my questions. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Alex. Thanks for the call.
Hey, Patrick.
Yeah.
While you're on the cremation topic, we just have a tweet here from Curious and Analytical. And that person asks, Patrick, my dad was cremated and his remains are back home with mom. His box container is on a shelf with the TV set. That was my brother's idea. Is this how it's supposed to be?
Good question. Short answer, no. The church says that that's not permitted. You're not allowed to have grandma's ashes on the grand piano in the living room or on the mantelpiece. The proper disposition of these remains should be in a Catholic cemetery. A columbarium is a term that's used for those buildings, often in Catholic cemeteries. Sometimes it's not even a building. It's just kind of like a wall that has niches where the urns can be reposed. And the church says that's the proper disposition of cremated remains. Now, some people either because they've never heard this, they don't know that the church requires this, they're not doing it out of malice, but just because they just didn't know. But when they do know, when they do discover the fact that, uh-oh, the church says I'm not supposed to do that, then they should take steps to move that urn into a Catholic cemetery, into a columbarium. The church also forbids the spreading of ashes. So no, you can't spread Grandpa's ashes on, you know, the Mississippi River because he loved to go there as a kid. You can't do that. You can't spread his ashes anywhere.
What about Lambeau Field? Are too,
not even there.
Not even there.
You know, Cyrus, did you ever see the movie called The Way, starring Martin Sheen?
Is that, where he walks the...
The Camino.
Camino, yes. No, I never did see it. I've only heard of it.
It's a good movie. A really good movie. With one exception, and that is he's a Catholic, and his son, Emilio Estevez, who directed the movie, and he also is in the movie briefly here and there, little flashes, because... Oh, boy, look at that. Well, anyway, Martin Sheen scatters his son's ashes on the way. That was the one drawback to the movie because it gives the impression that that's okay and it's not okay. The church says no. So I'll leave it at that. Hour three is about to start, so please stay right there. I'm coming right back with more of your phone calls right here on The Patrick Madrid Show. La, 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 la.